Supreme Court of the State of Nevada is now in session. The Honorable Justice Seda presiding.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Please be seated. We are here this morning. The first case before us is case number 55238. This is Emerson versus District Court. I have Mr. Emerson present, Mr. Eisenberg also present for the petitioner, and Mr. Coleman on behalf of the Real Party in Interest. Counsel, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, sir.
Do so.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I'm Robert Eisenberg, appearing for the petitioner, and Mr. Emerson is also here, and I will be arguing the entire case for our side, and I'm also going to attempt to reserve 5 minutes for
Very well.
The first issue I'd like to address is a key issue that's dispositive of the appeal, and that is the jurisdictional issue. The sanctions order was issued after the case was dismissed. The Jeep Corporation versus District Court case is crystal clear that once a case is dismissed pursuant to stipulation, the District Court loses jurisdiction. What this court said in the Jeep case was that upon filing of a stipulation, quote, the action is terminated and the court is without further jurisdiction in the matter. The Jeep Corporation court also said nothing can be done to fan the ashes of that action into life. The court said that the subsequent order was, quote, void ab initio, a complete and total nullity without force or effect. And then the court concluded by saying that the jurisdiction of the district court, quote, ended with the filing of the stipulation of dismissal. Now, in this case, the parties settled the case before the order was entered granting the sanctions. They filed a stipulation for dismissal with prejudice. The court, district court signed that order and it got filed. 3 weeks later, the court entered the sanctions order. And we believe that the district court was clearly without jurisdiction to do that under the Jeep Corporation case. Additionally, there's a two-prong element of reliance. When you stipulate to dismiss an appeal, the defense pays good money in exchange for a stipulation to dismiss so they can close their file and the case is over with. Here they pay their money, they get the stipulation to dismiss, but the district judge apparently felt that the case could remain open and he could take further action on it.
Mr. Eisenberg, are you proposing that under no circumstance would a district court have any collateral jurisdiction whatsoever on a case once it has been closed, as you suggest?
If there's a stipulation to dismiss, the jurisdiction is ended. The only possible exception to that that I can think of would be a Rule 50B motion where, for example, one of the parties claims that the stipulation for dismissal was obtained through fraud. But that's the only exception that I can think of to that rule. Now, the other element of reliance that I wanted to mention was the fact that the district court here on remand granted a new trial. Because this was unobjected to misconduct, the plaintiff had to prove that there was no other reasonable explanation for the defense verdict other than the misconduct. And the district judge found that. We believe that ruling was attackable on appeal, that we could have proved to this court that there were, in fact, other reasons based on the evidence at trial for the defense verdict other than the misconduct. By entering into the stipulation to dismiss the action, the defense was foregoing their right to challenge that order. And, of course, the sanctions order stemmed from the order granting the new trial. So when you have a stipulation to dismiss a case and you paid good money in exchange for that stipulation, that should be the end of the story.
Just like consideration in a contract.
Correct, Your Honor. And because it's a jurisdictional issue, that there really is no basis for distinguishing this from the Jeep Corporation case. Now, I'd also like to point out that the stipulation for dismissal, if the plaintiff's counsel wanted to continue pursuing the sanctions motion that was still pending in the district court, they had some options. They could have informed the defense that they didn't want to enter into the stipulation until after the sanctions issue was resolved, or perhaps they could have put something into the stipulation informing the district court that the sanctions issue is still pending and that they wanted the court to retain jurisdiction somehow to decide that issue. But they didn't do that. They settled. And in fact, plaintiff's counsel, not Mr. Coleman, but the attorney who argued the motion for reconsideration, conceded at the oral argument on that motion that she could have held off on the stipulation to dismiss until after the sanctions issue was decided, but she didn't. And so for that reason, we think the jurisdictional issue is clear. There's another important point that I think needs to be made. The sanctions issue, as I say, stemmed from the order granting the new trial. With all due respect to this court, the motion for new trial had to be based on basically an impossible task that this court imposed on the district judge when you remanded it in the Leosi opinion, based on a mistake in that opinion. And the mistake was Mr. Coleman never objected during the argument, didn't move for a mistrial at the end of the case, and he did not include the attorney misconduct issue in his motion for new trial. Filed a docketing statement in this court, didn't include that issue. About a year and a half after the trial, he files an amended docketing statement, raising for the first time the attorney misconduct issue. In the first Leosi opinion, this court said that the attorney misconduct issue was raised in his motion for new trial. And that's important because before you can raise an issue in this court, you have to preserve it somewhere in the district court. We pointed out in our petition for a rehearing that the court made a mistake and that he hadn't raised the issue in the new trial motion. When the court issued the second Leosi opinion, the court changed the opinion but didn't deal with that issue. So the mistake about whether he raised it in the new trial remained in the second opinion. And the reason I say that you remanded it with an impossible task for the district judge is you remanded it with instructions for the judge to decide the attorney misconduct issue in the motion for new trial based on the new standards set forth in the Leosi opinion. But the misconduct issue wasn't in the motion for new trial, so there was nothing to which the district court could have applied the new standards. Everybody's kind of scratching their heads thinking, okay, what do we do? Well, the district judge allowed Mr. Coleman to file a supplemental motion for new trial, raising the misconduct issue for the first time ever, 4 years after the trial, first time ever in the district court, and then the district judge granted it. And I think that's important in the context of these sanctions, because plaintiff's counsel has had one bite at the apple after another, failing to object at trial, failing to raise it in his motion for new trial. He gets a remand from this court based on what I'm arguing is based just a factual mistake. And then it gets back, he has a judge who applies the new standard that it's impossible for a verdict without, for this verdict to have been rendered but for the misconduct. And then after all that, they stipulate to dismiss the case with prejudice, and now he says the district court has jurisdiction to do that. Got break after break after break. And we just don't believe that it's fair and reasonable under these circumstances to allow that. As to the motion for sanctions itself, the sanctions, when an attorney misconduct has caused a new trial, the result of the attorney misconduct is the new trial and the expenses incurred for the new trial. This judge gave attorney's fees, costs, including $5,000 for a doctor who testified at the first trial. The expenses for the first trial were not caused by the misconduct. If there was misconduct that caused a new trial, it's the expenses for the new trial. And in fact, the motion for sanctions itself sought the additional, that's the word it used, the additional expenses caused by the granting the new trial.
What is the standard if you've got an attorney who's caused a mistrial and the judge imposes the costs and fees related to the first trial?
Well, I don't know if the judge can do that because under the statute, the only statute I'm aware of and the only statute that was briefed here, and I would just mention as a side note, that Judge Herndon, in this case, when he granted the sanctions, did not indicate what legal authority he was relying on. But there is a statute, NRS 7.085, which essentially says that if an attorney's conduct causes a new trial, then the statute says that the attorney can be required personally to pay the additional costs, expenses, and attorney's fees reasonably incurred because of such conduct. And so in your question involving a mistrial, I would suggest that it's the additional expenses that are incurred after the mistrial that are caused by the attorney's misconduct. And here the case settled. They never had a second trial. We contend that was just wrong. And in fact, as I recall, in the first Leosi opinion, this court said that Mr. Emerson could be required to pay the costs of the first trial, but the court didn't cite any authority for that. And you took that out of the second opinion. So although the respondents here are relying on that language from the first opinion, it was removed from the second opinion. I see that I only have 5 minutes left, and we do contend that the sanction itself was grossly disproportionate and not appropriate here. The case law that this court cited in the Leosi opinion dealing with sanctions were $250, things like that. Additionally, in the Williams case, I think it was the Williams case, the court said that when there's a published opinion, publishing to the world forever, that an attorney has committed misconduct, that published opinion is lasting professional injury that constitutes a significant sanction. And in the Williams case, the court said that's enough of a sanction without any monetary sanction. Here, not only was Mr. Emerson the subject of a published opinion, which many plaintiffs' lawyers, they don't refer to it as Leosi versus Cohen. They refer to it as the Emerson opinion. And in addition, the court referred him to the state bar. And we respectfully suggest that was enough and that this sanctions order was an abuse of discretion. I'm sorry I'm losing my voice. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time.
Certainly.
Thank you.
Mr. Coleman.
Thank you. My name is Ed Coleman. I'm here appearing on behalf of Mr. Leosi. I welcome you. It's sunny Southern Nevada without snow. Mr. Eisenberg is selling his car snowed in at the airport, so we're happy, but we're going to get some rain anyway. I think that the argument about jurisdiction presented by Mr. Eisenberg, whom I've known for quite a few years, is somewhat disingenuous in view of the fact that we cited a lot of cases in our responsive answer, including a number of federal cases. Both U.S. Supreme Court cases as well as circuit court cases. And all of those cases hold that if there's an ancillary matter, the court has jurisdiction. Now, is this proceeding or was this proceeding for sanctions an ancillary matter? Obviously, it was because this case before the court today is not an appeal. It's an ancillary matter. It's done by way of a petition for a writ, which makes it an ancillary matter by its own force. So the cases we cited, and I don't want to repeat these cases because I thought our brief was pretty extensive, and I trust the court has been able to read our brief. But the United States Supreme Court, and we cited the case, which is Counter and Gall versus Herman Corporation, and a whole series of circuit cases from the Fifth Circuit, from the Third Circuit, from the Tenth Circuit, all federal cases, and there's no case in Nevada that we know of, unless this is a case of first impression, say that it's an ancillary matter when it comes to the imposing of attorney's fees and sanctions.
I guess, Mr. Coleman, my question is, as counsel indicated, this was all part and parcel of a settlement agreement. They've given up their right to contest the new trial and appeal that determination, and this was all part and parcel of a finalization, and I guess it's a little bothersome to me that this has cropped up, and apparently it was unanticipated as part of those negotiations for a global settlement of the matter.
Well, I don't want to
do we go back and unwind everything, perhaps, and go back to square one and let the negotiations go forward to, include the sanction issue?
Well, I don't want to bring up extrinsic matters, but the settlement process itself, to which Mr. Eisenberg referred, about money and so on and so forth, that's an extrinsic matter to what happened here. And I don't want to get into that, but I could get into it because I was part of that settlement process. And it has nothing to do with the fact that there was a new trial granted. And in order to avoid that new trial, that stipulation for dismissal occurred because neither party really wanted to go through another trial.
And well, neither party addressed in the settlement, apparently, what would occur or the effect of the settlement on the collateral consequences of the Supreme Court's remand on sanctions.
You're absolutely correct as of record. There were discussions about this, but obviously it's extrinsic to the issues of the case at this point. Can't bring up new issues. However, as I indicated, the citations that we've given you show that this is an ancillary proceeding. Now, Mr. Emerson thought it was the court had jurisdiction. He made a motion for reconsideration of the sanctions. And now he's raised the issue of jurisdiction, although at the time he submitted to the jurisdiction by asking for reconsideration from Judge Herndon. And if you read Judge Herndon's statements of record, which we cited in our brief, you'll see what Judge Herndon said. Basically, he said, the sanctions go for the expenses of the prior trial. You caused, through your miscreant conduct, a new trial to be approved, and it was approved. We did get the motion was granted for a new trial. And you put these people through a whole series of preparations and trial, which was a two-day jury trial. You wasted the public's money. You wasted a lot of time through your misconduct, and now you're coming here and saying that the sanctions only are imposed for something in the future, when in fact Judge Herndon made it quite clear, and we have his statement cited incidentally in our brief, as to what the purpose of the sanctions were, which is really the causation of the expenses for the first trial. So as far as the conduct discerned, which this court has now ruled on several times, and I have to differ with Mr. Eisenberg about there being a new standard or some kind of new ruling. The conduct of Mr. Emerson was something that was an ethical matter that went back years, maybe hundreds of years, of not being able to be that kind of a presentation to a jury. I won't get into why I didn't object to it at the time. I'd made a lot of objections during that trial, as a matter of fact, and Judge Bell said, stop objecting. You're causing a delay. So I didn't object to it. Not that I didn't want to object to it, but I was afraid to offend the court.
What's your position with respect to Mr. Eisenberg's point that on remand, the court was faced with the dilemma that you had failed to articulate misconduct as a basis for new trial, and the court's remedy was to allow you to amend your new trial motion to articulate that ground after the remand had occurred. Is that the case?
Yes, however, We attached a copy of this court's remand order and the opinion, which incorporated the fact that Mr. Emerson had was guilty of misconduct as in an ethical sense, as well as probably on the merits itself. But we did incorporate this court's rulings, and we're using that as a basis.
What this court said in the second Leosi opinion was that the subject of whether a new trial should be granted or not should be reserved to the district court.
Correct, correct.
Not assumed by us at the Supreme Court level.
Right, but the Supreme Court...
So that sent you all back based on the pleadings as she existed at the time.
Correct, correct.
And what counsel's telling us is misconduct was not a grounds for a new trial motion.
Well, I submit that it was, because we specifically incorporated the opinion, in the actual opinion, a copy of which went with our motion, and that motion was based upon the opinion of the court remanding the district court.
Well, that was the supplemental motion. But your original motion for new trial did not seek a new trial on misconduct grounds.
That's correct. And I can tell Your Honor that that motion for reconsideration, the original one, was heard by a senior judge who looked at me in the eye and he said, I'm not going to overrule anything a jury did or Judge Bell ruled on. He didn't even read it. It was a pretty distasteful situation for us. We thought we had good grounds for it, so be it. But you're right. We did not cite misconduct of counsel in that original motion for reconsideration. But we did refer to it specifically in the motion before Judge Herman. We specifically said, courts remanded this because of this misconduct. And Judge Herman bought that argument and ruled that there was a basis for a new trial. And he granted our motion based on that. Jurisdictional issue, which I think is the key issue Mr. Eisenberg started out talking about, I don't want to repeat myself too much, but the fact is that this was an ancillary matter. And in those cases that we cited, those federal cases, all relate to that. And there were dismissals in those cases as well. And the court was not deprived of jurisdiction on ancillary matters. And this is an ancillary matter. Mr. Emerson... Mr. Emerson, of course, says that there's no due process, when in fact his conduct deprived us of due process, deprived our client of due process, and this court so held. So the due process part of it is hearing here before this court at this time. He's got his chance to appear and then argue his case. The fact is that the sanctions were imposed under the Nevada statute, which you cited in great detail here, because the length of the time, because of the cost of that first trial. And I think that that's an appropriate means of letting an attorney know, you can't do this, this is wrong. You seek justice when you deprive someone of justice, and this is improper. So I think that we submit that this court should follow the federal court's rulings in all the circuits that have heard this issue. And we cited them on page 6 of our brief, cited all the federal cases which are involved. And I also asked the court to once again read Judge Herndon's rulings. We've cited specific language from the transcript in which he states his reasons for his ruling on imposing sanctions. And I think that a simple reading of those justifies denying this petition.
Counsel, we've read all the transcripts and the petitions in this case.
Well, I'm happy to hear that, Justice Hardy.
Surprise, surprise.
Well,
sometimes lawyers wonder, but they're all right here. he'd like to see all the yellow lines.
I've personally appeared before the other judges, and you're not, Your Honor, and they know that I respect the court's abilities, and I trust that I can gain your respect as well, Your Justice Hartstein.
Sure.
But this is not the first time that I've been in front of Judge Perigeri or Justice Perigeri and Justice Saida. So I do respect this court and what this court does. But I think as a follow-up on your opinion, in the underlying Leosi case, the second opinion in which you remanded that you opened the door, so to speak, for the district court to do what it did do in this case. And I submit that that was proper conduct. And this petition for prohibition or mandamus should be denied. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Coleman. Mr. Eisenberg, on rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just three quick points. First, counsel three times referred to the string of cases that he cites at page 6 of his answer. None of those cases involved a stipulation for dismissal. And in fact, they were all either unilateral notices of voluntary dismissal or dismissals, involuntary dismissals, such as motion to dismiss granted. None of them are like this case. And Justice Seda, you asked earlier whether there's any exception to the rule I'm propounding. I mentioned Rule 60B, and I point out to you that the Smith case that's cited on page 6 of the answer does indicate that a stipulation deprives the district court of all jurisdiction except Rule 60B relief. The second point I wanted to make is that Mr. Coleman says he won't get into why he didn't object. Well, he answered that question in his answer to this writ petition. After all this time, we finally find out, why didn't he object during the closing arguments? Why didn't he raise it in his motion for new trial? Why didn't he even raise it in his docketing statement in this course? And it's on page 2 of his answer to the writ petition, where he says that Mr. Emerson is correct in saying that Leosi's counsel made no objections to the closing argument, nor in the motion for new trial, nor in the docketing statement. And here's what he says. This had been merely a strategic and tactical judgment made by Mr. Leosi's counsel, which later changed after it appeared that such misconduct would be the issue most likely to succeed on appeal. So halfway through the appeal, he changes his mind and decides there's a better issue. This is exactly the situation that Chief Justice Maupin talked about in his separate opinion in the Cantorino case, and that Justice Rose talked about in his dissenting opinion in De Jesus versus Flick, that attorneys make strategy and tactical decisions at trial not to object. And when they do that, they shouldn't be rewarded later when they've gambled and they've lost. The last point I want to make is that in sort of an oblique way, Mr. Coleman has suggested that we're challenging Leosi versus Coleman, the basic proposition that Mr. Emerson committed misconduct. We disagree with that opinion, obviously, but we lost. We argued it and we lost. We accept that opinion. We are not challenging or in any way asking this court to change the opinion to the extent that this court determined that Mr. Emerson committed misconduct. We accept that. The court has no further questions. I appreciate the opportunity to have argued.
Justice Hurston, Justice Berger.
In the motion for reconsideration, which I haven't had a chance to look at again, did you challenge the court's jurisdiction?
That's a difficult question to answer. It was pointed out to the judge in the motion.
Does the motion include as a grounds the absence of the judge's jurisdiction to enter the order on September 11th?
Not in those terms. It pointed out to the judge that the order was entered after the settlement. And then at the oral argument,
the hearings on the motions occurred before the settlement. The hearings on the motions for sanctions occurred before the case was settled.
That's correct, and the judge rendered a tentative decision from the bench.
On the same day that the dismissal order was entered?
Well, no, that was quite some time earlier.
I thought the dismissal order and the tentative ruling on sanctions were both entered on the same day on August 24th.
That's incorrect. The hearing on the motion for sanctions
was held on July 22nd.
That's correct. The judge orally granted it, but he didn't have, it wasn't a complete motion because he didn't have the amount that Mr. Coleman was seeking. He didn't have any backup for it. Then the stipulation to dismiss was filed, and that was on August 19th, 2009. Mm-hmm. The order dismissing the action, the judge signed it, and it was filed on August 24th. The order granting sanctions was 3 weeks later on September 11th.
Wasn't there also a tentative order entered with respect to the sanction?
It was tentative from the bench. And I say tentative, the judge didn't use that term, but it had to have been tentative because the judge didn't have any information about the amount of money being sought. Mm-hmm. That didn't appear in this record until Mr. Coleman filed a declaration that's attached to the order granting sanctions.
Okay, I didn't let you fully answer my question. I thought it was a yes or no response, but you wanted to embellish on the motion for reconsideration. Did you challenge jurisdiction of the court in the motion for reconsideration?
Not in those terms, but I would also point out
in what terms then?
By using the phrase jurisdiction. The facts were pointed out to the judge that the order for sanctions was entered after this case was dismissed pursuant to the stipulation. And then at the hearing on that motion, plaintiff's counsel responded to that contention and suggested that that didn't make a difference. And I would also point out, Your Honor, that this
is a
jurisdictional...
But nobody told Judge Herndon you don't have jurisdiction.
I'm sorry?
Nobody told Judge Herndon you don't have jurisdiction.
That's correct. But a jurisdictional issue of the district court can always be raised in this court for the first time, even if you conclude that the motion for reconsideration was insufficient in that.
And one final question, Mr. Eisenberg. You believe that there's some uncertainty in the law in Nevada about a district court judge's jurisdiction to consider collateral consequences in a trial, such as attorney's fees and lawyer sanctions?
Whether a judge has jurisdiction to consider that at all?
Yeah.
I don't think
post-verdict or post-dismissal?
No, I don't think so. If there's some legal basis for it, Rule 11, NRS 7.085, NRS 18.010, there's legal authority for that probably would reach that.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Eisenberg. Mr. Coleman, Mr. Eisenberg, Mr. Emerson, thank you for your time and your attention here today. This matter will stand submitted.